showing me that it is. So hi, everybody. In case we're streaming, I say hi. Let me get over to YouTube and see.
Okay, I'm taking us live on Facebook.
Okay.
Check YouTube because let me see.
Okay, I'll zoom over there.
I mean, it's good.
Okay.
Let me open YouTube. Second.
Yeah, follow. It says that you're live. Let me get over there.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Yeah, we are. I can see it. So.
Okay, great.
Let me just.
Hello, people.
Get so I can see the chat. Actually, what I can do. Let's see if this will work, YouTube. I can do the YouTube chat on my iPad, which will make it better, I think.
I can look over at Facebook too. Let me check it out. And oh no, that's the wrong page. I can look over at Facebook too. Check it out.
Okay, how do I need to get this? Where are the comments? How do we get the comments?
We're almost there. Sorry, guys. Yaron's on the road, so this is not his usual setup. So what's my excuse? That's the question.
Did they say that?
No. I'm asking myself. I'm harder on myself than anybody could ever be.
How do I live chat?
Yeah, we're over here at Facebook. Hello, hello.
Okay, there we go. Okay, so I'm gonna.
Beautiful.
I'm gonna close that. I am gonna open that. That is Facebook. Mm-hmm. That's good. Even Pamela Benson is on Facebook. Look at that.
I know. So maybe we should be doing our show on Sunday so we can have her.
Yeah. Hey, Hillary. All right, let's see what we're gonna do here. Hi, everybody. Sorry we're late. Sorry we're confused, but I'm trying to get this set up in my hotel room in Brazil. And because Amy's joining me, the setup is different than yesterday's, so it's all very confusing. But here we are. Welcome to Yaron and Amy Show. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how's it going?
It's going okay. Got a little bit of whiplash from a minor car bang up.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm okay.
In the car?
No, I wasn't, but everybody was okay. And okay. I'm the only one that has anything that's sore.
Good.
So,
good.
Yeah.
Well, I was running late because I had to go while I'm in Brazil and get some acai. It was so good. It was so
okay.
Good. Anyway.
Yep. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. So I had this theme and I agonized over the title and I'm very proud of my little title, Land good. Of the Kept, Home of the Cowed. And we can go through that. But you said you wanted to first start out with the attack in Syria, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that the attack in Syria is anything, I think, special, unfortunately. I mean, Syrians are killing Syrians, and they're killing them in horrible, horrific fashion. I don't know that people know how horrific, how many of the listeners know how horrific dying from gas is. But let me tell you, there's very few deaths that are more horrific, slow, agonizing, and disgusting than dying of a gas attack. When we were in the Israeli army, we would watch videos of what it looked like. That was part of it to incentivize us to put on our suits, our gas mask suits, and wear our gas masks, and also for us just to realize what we were facing. And of course, back then, this was 1979, 80, the Syrians already had chemical weapons. So this is not a new phenomenon. It's not different. But I think, so the Syrians are killing each other in horrific ways. My view's always been we should stay out of Syria. I don't think it's our business. I think let them kill each other. It's sad. It's sad to watch particularly children dying this way. But at the end of the day, this is their conflict. You know what? I screwed up. I didn't record this. Okay, so we'll have to take the audio from YouTube or Facebook to get it up.
Yeah, it's possible to download that. That's no problem.
Okay. So, at the end of the day, the Syrians, you know, it's not America's business. There's no American national interest. There's no American rights that are at stake here. I mean, if you wanted to make the case that they are, you would have to go back to Iran, because Iran is the major player in Syria. And therefore, the war shouldn't be in Syria. It should be in Iran, which is what the war should have been post 9/11 anyway. So the whole thing is. But Donald Trump, when he ran for president, and I apologize, we have to bring up Trump again, but what can we do?
Well, we will anyway. Is,
everywhere. When he ran for president, said, oh, we're not going to do Syria. We're not going to get involved. And then when the last chemical attack happened, he was outraged. Supposedly his daughter came to him and said, look how women and children are dying, and isn't this horrible? It's kind of an altruistic. And he said, okay, this is unacceptable. I won't accept chemical attacks. You guys have got to stop. And he lobbed some missiles into Syria that didn't kill really anybody. Wiped out some runways and then airports, but didn't do much at all. And it, you know, and I remember criticizing him then for that and saying, you know, I mean, if you want to stop the Syrian chemical attacks, you're gonna have to do more than this. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have done anything, but if you're gonna do something, what you did is Obama-like. It's not mm-hmm. anything different than Obama. It's the typical Weasley, pathetic, weak response that America always has. And everybody criticized me. Oh, no, Iran, he's tough. And, you know, Assad is paying attention and the Russians are paying attention. We really got to them this time. We really. Okay, so now there's another chemical attack. Obviously, nobody's afraid of Donald Trump. Nobody's afraid of America. Nobody's worried. And today he was again on television, some bombastic statement about, you know, calling Assad some, you know, some denouncing Assad and saying, oh, they will regret this. And it's just pathetic. It's just pathetic. And this is a consequence of not having a real foreign policy. Now, it's going to be interesting with John Bolton now as his national security advisor. And Bolton is pro-American intervention in Syria. So it'll be interesting now to see if who wins, kind of the old, what was the name of his strategy advisor, the guy who left, the nationalist?
Oh, gosh, it's so funny.
Bannon.
That we lost
Bannon.
Yes.
Bannon.
Yes.
So it will be interesting to know if the Bannon wing wins that says don't go to Syria, just lob some missiles or whatever, or the kind of the John Bolton wing wins, which means American troops in Syria. And of course, American troops in Syria means there was competition with Russia. And that goes into the whole story about Russia. And suddenly Putin's a bad guy. Suddenly Donald Trump thinks Putin's a bad guy. The whole thing, I mean, this is what happens when you don't have a foreign policy, when you don't have a coherent America first foreign policy. And Trump had a great name for his foreign policy, America First, great name, right? But he doesn't have an America First actual foreign policy. He has a, you know, pragmatic, you know, whatever, let's see what happens. I'll deal with it when it happens kind of foreign policy, just like every other president out there. There's nothing special. There's nothing different about him when it comes to, he's no worse and he's no better than Obama when it comes to these things. So I know what I just said, no better than Obama, people are going to freak out, but
didn't he recently say he was going to get out of Syria? So some people were saying,
yes,
that the timing of this is suspicious because he had said he was going to get out. And so I guess what this is.
So yes, it's the neocons. It's the neocons doing it. This is the conspiracy theory. I mean, this is a conspiracy theory I just made up right now.
Okay. Cause maybe it's similar to what I saw on Twitter, yeah, but I can't find one.
Neocons launched the attack on civilians in order to try to convince Trump to stay in Syria. That's stupid. But that's the kind of conspiracy theories out there. No, this is the Russians and the Syrians emboldened by the fact that America is weak, that mm-hmm. Trump is too occupied by his fantasies about China, that Trump has shown weakness in the past about Syria and the Middle East. And the Russians and the Syrians are taking advantage of that. By the way, when he said we're going to get out of Syria, other people within the administration say, no, not so fast. We still have to be there because ISIS is still there or whatever. That's the excuse for being in Syria is ISIS. I don't know. I mean, obviously, conspiracy theories don't work. They're not real. Partially because, for example, I'm sure Israeli intelligence know exactly who launched the attack, and they probably monitored the whole thing. My guess, it's the regime. My guess is it's the Russians. They're very emboldened. They're not afraid of Trump. They're not afraid of America. And, you know, this is the problem. Either get out, stay out, don't intervene. Whatever happens in Syria, serious problem, let it happen. That's one approach, mm-hmm. a legitimate one. And a second one is, be credible in the threats that you make. Do something and take a position. Like, are we pro-Assad? No. Are we pro the opposition to Assad? No. We actually cut funding to the opposition for Assad. Are we pro the Kurds? No, because we're actually supporting the Turks attacking the Kurds. Are we pro Turkey? Well, not really, because Turkey is now becoming more of an ally of Iran. So who are we pro? Who are we against? Do we have a strategy? No. This is the disaster that is the Middle East. And Trump, unless you have a rational, coherent, principled view of American self-interest, you cannot have a proper foreign policy. And what we're seeing is Trump have no foreign policy vis-a-vis Syria and the rest of the Middle East. He did his thing. He moved the embassy to Jerusalem. Yay. And that's, but he can't do anything else.
So what did he say he's going to do? He just is making noise right now. We don't know.
Well, he's going to go. He said something. Let me see if I can find it. He said something bombastic. Trump warns, a price to pay. That's one. That's one headline. Trump tweets condemnation of Syria chemical attack, saying Putin shares the blame.
Well, that's a better sign.
Yeah, but that's Bolton. That's Bolton. I think that's Bolton's influence. Let's see. He said something. Anyway, I can't find it, but he said something. He called Assad some name. But he promised a big price to pay, a big emphasis on big price to pay. So I want to see what that means. You remember the red line? You remember what Republicans did to Obama when you reneged on the red line?
Exactly.
Well, okay, let's see what Republicans do when Trump. They did nothing when he lobbed those missiles into the middle of nowhere that had obviously no impact because chemical weapons are being used again.
And they would have criticized it if it was Obama's lame.
They would have been criticizing everything in Syria if it was Obama. There's no question. I mean, and so would have a lot of our people watching here on YouTube and Facebook. I mean, Obama was the devil, and at least for some people, Trump is the salvation. So, and they treat them like that. Jesus can do no wrong, and the devil can do no right, and that is the way.
Well, that'll play into the theme of the show. But first, I want to give a shout out to Kirk in case you didn't see it over at YouTube.
Thank you, Kirk.
$5 super chat. Thank you. Did he have a question that you were supposed to address attached to that?
If anybody wants to ask a question, the only way to do it on YouTube chat is by doing the super chat. I'm not taking unpaid for questions today.
Wow. I wish I had such a privilege. I'm just over 500 subscribers at my YouTube channel. So people, please keep on coming. I need to get to 1,000 before I can even do.
Well, I'm trying to be more disciplined. Trying to be more disciplined and not get into arguments with people in the chat. All right.
Somebody's
asking, is permanent intervention the policy? No, I said the policy is either don't intervene at all in Syria, or if you're going to intervene, go to the source. And the source is not Syria. The source of our problems in Syria is Iran. So until you deal with the Iranian threat, nothing will change. So I still say that since 1979, we've been at war with Iran. We've got to take them out, whether we do it now or whether we do it when they have nukes. At some point, this is going to come to a head, and we're going to have to take them out. The actual stuff going on in Syria does not affect the United States. There's a certain point. There's a certain point that actually would suggest that the Syrians fighting, Sunnis and Shiites, radicals and moderates, killing each other, is not that bad for the United States. It's occupying them. It's probably good for Israel. Israel, the last thing Israel wants is one of the two sides to win, because if Assad wins, it means the Iranians honor Israel's border and they are a direct, immediate threat to Israel's security, and Hezbollah is much more emboldened than Assad, and you've got a direct link from Tehran to Beirut. They cover it all through Iraq. They have all of Syria, and they have all of Lebanon. That's the worst-case scenario. But if the opposition wins, the opposition is much more friendly to ISIS and al-Qaeda, particularly al-Qaeda. So that's a threat to Israel as well. Israel does not need al-Qaeda or ISIS on its northern border. So the best situation, in my view, for both Israel and the United States is that the Syrians keep killing each other, the Sunnis and Shiites keep going at it.
Okay, so then here's your conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
If we don't do anything, even some little kind of niggling thing to help keep this going, if we actually withdrew totally, would that mean Assad would take over and then?
Well, it would because of the Russians. So if there was a way to get Putin to stop supporting Assad, then you would have, if he would leave, then you would have something close to perpetual war there. As long as Putin is there helping Assad, Putin has the military resources to crush everybody in Syria. So
then does it become in our self-interest to stay there and do something not super definite?
No, because I don't know what you do. You can't dabble. I don't believe in dabbling.
Well, but if we don't want either side to win for a long time, I don't know. God, this is horrible.
Assad's going to win because Putin's there and Israel will have to deal with the consequence of that. America, either America goes to Tehran.
So withdraw and help Israel.
What's that?
Withdraw and be ready to help Israel.
Yeah. Well, we don't need to help Israel. Israel can take care of itself.
Okay.
All we need to do is not shackle Israel.
Okay.
What we've often done is shackled Israel. We just need to stop.
Hopefully,
shackling.
Trump at least won't do that. Yeah.
I don't know what Trump will do or won't do.
He's supposed to be better.
I don't speculate.
In some ways. I'm counting on some.
I don't speculate.
I'm counting on some.
Yeah.
Okay. So on to the theme of the show, which, you know, obviously it's a, you know, I'm kind of cashing in on the resemblance to the national anthem, the line from our anthem, "Land of the Free, Home of the Brave." Instead, we have "Land of the Kept, Home of the Cowed," which occurred to me after I was listening to your show yesterday, Yaron, because you were talking about the history of Argentina and how protectionism has destroyed the economy there.
Among many statist policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I was thinking about, of course, the trade war here and how supposedly we're being protected, but really it's being kept. We are not free in this way and you know, what the consequences are. And of course, this also integrates with the caravan coming from Honduras, and it's a big threat. So, of course, we have to send thousands of troops to the border, you know, because of this fear of these invaders coming into our country. So "Land of the Kept, Home of the Cowed" is kind of what we're turning into. Yeah. That's the feeling. And there's a couple other stories that tie into this as well. But I want people, of course, to go and look at your show from yesterday. But in a nutshell, can you talk about how this trade war, in effect, is going to turn us into Argentina and destroy the wealth here?
Well, I mean, if it gets really bad, then what's going to happen is we're going to get poorer. Trade with China is massively beneficial to American citizens, massively beneficial. I think I saw an estimate that it raises the wealth of a low-income to middle-income person in the United States by over $2,000 a year, which is a lot of money. And it raises the wealth of other people probably even more than that. I don't think there's an easy way to measure it. What would life be without iPhones? What would life be if iPhones were much more expensive? And of course, iPhones, all the trade numbers are screwed up because we think we've got this massive trade deficit with China. But then when you get an iPhone, only a little bit of the iPhone is China. But the whole amount of the iPhone, I think $200, gets attributed to the trade deficit with China. But the other components of the iPhone come from South Korea and Taiwan and Africa and all over the world. I think it's something like 40 different countries represented in the iPhone, 40 different companies from different countries. So it really depends on what happens with trade war. I'm coming to the conclusion, and I don't know, I hope I'm not being overly optimistic, that the Chinese are too smart to get into a trade war. You know, they're not as dumb as this administration is. and they don't really want to see the global economy tumble and to see the U.S. market, which is their best market, shrink. So if a trade war actually happens, then we've Smoot-Hawley raised tariffs significantly on almost all imports to the United States. So what we're doing right now is much more narrow than Smoot-Hawley. So we're not about to be Smoot-Hawley. But what happened in Argentina is because it was all expansive. It was massive. And basically, you got no cheap imports. You had to produce everything locally. And you would produce everything locally very expensive. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Argentinians couldn't afford what you were producing. So the only way the people in Argentina who are producing this stuff could actually make money is to export it. So it wasn't even available to Argentinians. They would just export it. So then the government put a tax on exports. So they couldn't export it. So they had to sell it to their own people. But you can see how this is a spiral towards poverty. This is a spiral towards decline. And if you go in Argentina today, the cars are really illustrative because the cars are small. A lot of used cars, they're manual shift, but they're all tiny. Even the difference between Argentina and here in Porto Alegre, Brazil, is significant. You're seeing much nicer cars, much bigger cars, much better cars here in Brazil. And the reason is there are massive tariffs on importation of cars. So you really are incentivized only to buy cars that are built in Argentina. Mm-hmm. All the car companies in the world go to Argentina, build cars there, but it's expensive. It's more expensive than building them locally. There's no economies of scale because if you build a car in the United States, if you build a million copies, some go to Argentina, some in the United States, some go to Mexico. Right. You get economies of scale. No, now you have to just build for the Argentinian markets. It's a small market. And so you become poorer. That's the consequence. Now, my hope is that China is smarter than Trump. I think in spite of them being authoritarians, they're smarter. And I think what the Chinese are ultimately going to do is they will give Trump a win. So they will take something that they intended to do anyway.
Mm.
And they will compromise on that thing. And it won't be very significant, but it'll be something that they were planning to do anyway, like liberalize the insurance market or liberalize some piece of the financial markets.
And he can brag about it.
And he can brag about it. See, I won. I got. It won't affect the trade deficit. The trade deficit, when he leaves office, I will guarantee is just going to be just as big as when he entered office, maybe bigger. It's actually growing over the last year because Americans are wealthier, so we're buying more stuff, which means importing more stuff because the economy's done well. So they will give in just to avoid this trade war. Now, in the meantime, the counter to that is the fact that so far they have played tit for tat. So he threatened $50 billion on certain items. They said, okay, we can match that dollar for dollar. We'll do $50 billion. Then he said, I'm gonna do another $100 billion. So they said, we can do $100 billion. So they did, so that's a disaster if that happens, but it's also a disaster for China. Now, I think China has more options than we do because I think China can probably export to other places in the world. But it's bad for China and America, and this is why I think it's kind of mutually assured destruction. That's why I think that I hope that the Chinese are smarter than Trump and will give him something so that he can brag.
Well,
all our listeners will say, told you, Iran, you were wrong. Look what a genius Trump is. He got the Chinese to compromise. Really?
Again, the method of trying to get somebody else to do something by threatening your own people with force, I don't know. What I did see in the Times, and I stuck this in the program notes over at my blog, don'tletitgo.com, for anybody who wants to check it out. Farmers' anger at Trump tariffs puts Republican candidates in a bind. So the Republicans are starting to get pressure from some of their big base, which is the farmers.
The whole Midwest, Yeah. And the funny thing is, again, this is the Midwest that gets subsidies for their farm products. There's not a product in the Midwest, in Farm Belt, that is not produced through subsidies. And of course, Trump, when he campaigned in Iowa and elsewhere, was very pro-farm subsidies. He's still very pro-farm subsidies. And then he complains about the Chinese subsidizing their goods. But what about what we subsidize?
We do it. Yes, we do it as well. Yeah. And, you know, this goes again, we're in the United States, we are increasingly becoming more and more kept and less free, you know, hence the title. But here they are, you know, they're saying, okay, well, we like the way we are. I guess, you know, probably if you tried to take away their subsidies, they'd be upset about that as well. But certainly they see the potential devastating losses that they're going to suffer if there is this trade war with China.
Yeah. So let me, there's a comment here, which is sure. which is interesting that I think is worth commenting on. One of the writers says, the rare metals used in iPhones, hybrid cars, and other high tech is more long-term issue. The vast majority, 90% of those metals are mined in China. So,
wow, okay.
That was true. Not true anymore. And so about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I don't remember the exact timing of this, the Chinese started restricting exports of rare metals. And what happened was a lot of the technology companies came up with alternatives to those rare metals. And there's also now, they've discovered rare metals in other places around the world. You know, unfortunately, they're not mining as much, but in Mongolia, for example, has a lot of rare metals. But they're finding rare metals in other places around the world. So the chokehold the Chinese originally had on rare metals by preventing their exports, markets work. By preventing their exports, markets figured out ways not to use those rare metals as much or invested money in going mining places that still have rare metals that restricted the so-called monopoly that the Chinese have on it. Markets work, guys. I'm not worried about anything the Chinese do economically because markets do actually work.
Well, and sometimes, of course, people want the solution to be instantaneous too, and maybe that's that, but you have to have some patience for things that are worthwhile, like freedom, right? Yep. Sometimes we have to have patience for it. So, so the hope is that the Chinese are going to save Trump from himself, so to speak, or maybe he's going to give in to some of the demands that he's getting from different pressure groups. Because that's really the way that I see him. I see him as sort of flapping in the wind, figuring out which demands he's going to listen to. And when he gets a chorus of demands now from the farmers and also some of the candidates who are trying to get reelected in the districts with these farmers and stuff, they're starting to put pressure on him as
yes.
well.
Yes. So I think there's going to be a lot of political pressure. We live in a country, we live in a world that is run by pressure groups, that is run by gangs. This is what Ayn Rand predicted. This is what Ayn Rand said would happen with a mixed economy. It has to happen. Nobody today in the political world is principled. It's just which gang are they most loyal to? And Trump, being the ultimate pragmatist, is, you know, has multiple gangs that are pulling and pushing in different directions. And what he's going to do tomorrow, who knows? But by the way, this trade stuff is interesting because in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan came out of a lot of political pressure to do something about Japan. If you remember, Japan was taking over the world. It was going to become the biggest economy in the world. It was, we were losing everything to Japanese, the cars and everything else. And Reagan came under a lot of kind of a pressure group politics to do something about the competition from Japan. So he threatened... tariffs. And the Japanese are much smaller than China, and they knew they were vulnerable. So they basically said, oh, don't do that. We'll give you some stuff. We'll give in to some stuff. So they self-imposed quotas on export of automobiles, and they started building plants in the U.S. So today, Japanese companies employ hundreds of thousands of Americans in auto factories in the U.S. That doesn't make any economic sense. Again, economies of scale would suggest that they should be building them in Japan, maybe even in China, and then exporting to the U.S. But they did that because of the self-imposed restrictions that were part of the big compromise that Reagan got with the Japanese. The question is, will the Chinese behave the same way? Because the one thing the Chinese do not want to be perceived as, and you have to understand the Chinese are very nationalist. Mm. Very much, this is China, right? So what they won't want to be perceived at is having given in. They won't. So they have to compromise in a way that lets them present to their own public, we won, and it lets Donald Trump present in a way that he wants. So there's huge risks here in terms of what it's ultimately is ultimately going to happen.
So it's one nationalist, one flavor versus the other. And
yeah, but the whole that's the way the world is going.
Okay, so let's get into the big scary for some topic, which is the Honduran Central American migrants who have been crossing Mexico in a caravan. There's a CNN piece that I picked up yesterday that describes who some of these people are. And the last that I read of, at first they were saying there was 1,200, and then I saw 1,100. And now they're saying of the 1,100, that only about 200 actually plan to continue their journey all the way to the United States. A number of them are going to be in Mexico and stuff. Have you read enough about these people to know whether they're any sort of security threat at all?
I haven't, but I find it hard to believe that they are. I mean, this is not a public caravan of gang members coming into the country. You know, at the end of the day, the purpose of a caravan is to be symbolic. The purpose of the caravan is to point to the immigration issues that exist in America and the fact that many people would like to, Central Americans, not Mexicans, Central Americans would like to come to the United States and are not being allowed to come to the United States. So I think the caravan is primarily symbolic, but there's no evidence that I can see that this is gang members. Or this is, what is that gang, something 13, that is really, really nasty and really evil.
MS-13 or something?
MS-13. I don't see any evidence that it's MS-13. And of course, Trump goes on and says, there's massive quantity of rape going on in this caravan. This caravan is a caravan of rapists. And the women there are being raped like crazy. He tweeted this.
I haven't seen any of that in the reporting that I read, but yeah.
There's no reporting on that. Because it's a caravan, there's a lot of journalists there. It's being monitored by the Mexican police. There's absolutely no evidence of that. But that's typical Trump BS of him trying to exaggerate and make it look really evil. You know, MS-13 is a real problem. It's a growing problem all over the United States. It's a gang. It's a violent gang. It is funded by drugs. The only way to really eliminate MS-13 is not through better immigration controls. The way to limit MS-13 is to end the war on drugs.
Yes.
If it's not MS-13, there'll be somebody else who takes over that gig. But MS-13 is all over the United States, not only in the border states, but all over. And law enforcement needs to do something about it. And it's not an immigration issue. It's a crime issue. It's a law enforcement issue. And they need to handle it. And by the way, the wrong way to handle it is by deporting these people, sending them back to their home countries, because all they do is they cross the border back over. By the way, if you build a wall, they'll still cross over, unless you want to build a wall in the ocean, unless you want to build a wall in Canada as well. And unless the wall doesn't have holes for the cows to come back and forth, like the Comet wall that exists in California has. So the whole thing is stupid. But so, yeah, we got to deal with MS-13. You got to deal with drug, with gangs. You got to deal with crime. You got to deal with criminals who come here. The best thing to do with criminals that you catch is to put them in jail and throw away the keys. Mm-hmm. I'm much more sympathetic to the idea of putting criminals on water and bread, real criminals, violent criminals, on water and bread and keeping them in isolation than I am in sending them back home so they can smuggle themselves back in here or in their home, kill people over there. You know, if jail is too expensive, then
make it cheaper.
But of course, the courts won't let you because it's considered
it's cruel,
and cruel and just. What is it? The Fourth Amendment,
but Eighth, cruel and unusual. Yeah,
cruel and unusual. The Eighth Amendment. Mm-hmm. So there's problems with that. But I'm all for cruel and unusual punishment for people who are violent, and let out of jail all the people.
But again, you know, if you legalize drugs, and you get away, you get rid of the whole money making opportunities for these gang members. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. No, legalization of drugs would dramatically reduce crime in the United States. Dramatically. It's not even close.
But instead, Trump is escalating the drug war to include opioids, even prescription.
Yeah, but let's, I mean, the fact is Trump is just being a Republican. I mean, that's just a typical Republican thing. It doesn't work. Let's double up on it. Right? So the war on drugs hasn't worked. Let's double up on it. It's the same thing the Democrats do with the so-called war on poverty. It doesn't work. So let's double up on it.
Yeah, and in fact, now the New York Times was calling for a new front in the war on poverty, because now poverty's gone to the suburbs, but the war on poverty hasn't, and so we have to extend it there. So
how has poverty gone to the suburbs? I don't get that.
You'll have to read the New York Times article. I just looked at the headline. So
okay, you'll have to send it to me.
I will do that. You know, you want more bad news, right? Yeah, no, but that's what they're saying.
You know, my talk at OCON is going to be on how to be a rational optimist.
I saw that yesterday. I said, you're going to have,
and you know, people are complaining about our show that we're too negative.
Are we?
Yeah, that's what they say.
I've got some stuff at the end today.
You have some positive stuff?
Because this is the point of this show, right? The theme is that we are supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yeah.
And we should not, at least as objectivists, be arguing for policy proposals that are based on fear or on the need for government to, quote, protect us from things that we needn't have protection from.
So you mean we shouldn't, as objectivists, be advocating for tariffs and taxing, increasing taxing, taxes, increasing regulations? But China, we have to be afraid. See, that's the thing.
China's unfair.
Well, it's worse than unfair. I mean, what's and this is the thing about Trump, which why I spend so much time attacking him. He is hooked into something really nasty in the American public, evil and bad in the American public, which is fear. And
yes.
And everything he does is based on the notion of fear. It's to scare us and then offer some increasing government controls as a solution. So, oh my God. People are going to cross the border. Undocumented people are going to cross the border. Illegal immigrants, they're breaking the law. So we're going to increase government control by putting soldiers at the border. Right?
A number of my followers on Facebook have said just that. Yes. That it's actually good for Trump to be sending troops to the border to meet this caravan.
Yes. So increase the power of the state, increase the power of government. Get government involved in more things, because they're not involved in enough things today. And now get the military involved in domestic policy in the United States, which is to protect, to literally protect our border, not against an invading army, not against terrorists, but against farm workers. You know, protect us against Guatemalans who want to come pick strawberries. So we need to send the troops. So we've got a problem with trade. There are not enough jobs in America. We're losing productive jobs. China is cheating China, which it is, right? It's subsidizing, which we do as well, but they're doing more of it. So we need to increase the power of government. We need to raise taxes. We need to increase the power that government has or control over what we buy, at what price we buy stuff, and from whom we buy the stuff, and ignoring completely the principle, which is the trade fundamentally is between individuals. Governments don't trade. Countries don't trade. Collectives don't trade. I buy something from some guy in China, and it's the same thing about immigration. If I buy something from some guy in China, how is it your business who I buy it from? If it's from Arkansas or Texas or Nevada or China, it's none of anybody's business who I choose to do business with unless
they're a security risk. That country is an enemy.
Or they're an enemy, or I'm importing some product that might explode and kill everybody, right? Or some chemical weapon I'm importing from Syria. Right. Other than that, there is no interest. And the same with immigrants. I should have every right in the world to drive down to Juarez and load up my thing with Guatemalans who want to work in my factory. And as long as they don't pose a security threat, as long as they're not criminals or terrorists or carry infectious diseases, how is it anybody's business who I employ? And now not only do we want to stop them at the border, but once they're across, we want employers to become policemen and run security checks on them. What do they call that? There's a system.
Background checks or something.
Yeah, where you run checks to make sure that they're legal in the United States. It's just despicable.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the whole thing. Yeah. So yes, we have been kind of negative, but the thing that I'm going meta negative on is this attitude of fear. You know, are we the land of the free and the home of the brave? That's what we're supposed to be. But Trump is one of a long line of politicians, and he's really good at playing on the fear, I think, Trump more than the other ones. But the land of the kept, the home of the cowed.
I mean, I'm going to argue this summer And maybe nobody will come to my talk, or maybe they'll excommunicate me from objectivism. I don't know. But I'm going to argue this summer that there's very little to be afraid of, or the thing to be afraid of most is us. It's the American people. That's who you should be afraid of. And the people you should be afraid of are Trump and Clinton and Obama and Sanders, and it's us. And indeed, the rest of the world is getting better. The rest of the world is getting richer. The rest of the world is getting more free, you know, with the exception maybe of Europe. And the generally life, from the perspective of violence, from the perspective of things to fear, germs, violence, terrorism, nuclear weapons, from all those perspectives, the world today is probably the safest it's ever been. Now, that could change if Iran gets the bomb, but we could deal with that, but we're not willing to. But from the perspective of everything out there, so more and more people around the world are becoming middle class, which means more and more people around the world are producing and consuming, which means we could be a thousand times, you know, 10 times richer than we are, because we now have massive consumer markets out there in the world. But also we could be getting in America really, really, really cheap goods to bolster our standard of living, because China is just the tip of the iceberg. What about India? What about Vietnam? What about Africa? When Africa starts liberalizing their economies and start being productive and start producing things that we could benefit from. And this fear mentality, this mentality of, oh my God, first of all, it's not just fear. It's this nationalism. It's, you know, I'm a huge American exceptionalism guy, right? But first of all, there's less and less special about America. Now, I know I'm going to be killed for this, right? About America today, not about its founding. Not, there's less and less special about America. And second, even if you're an American exceptionalist, the fear that we have of the foreigners and the resentment and the hatred and is just so un-American. And it is so anti-prosperity and anti-freedom and anti-life and anti-benevolence. And so I find the whole thing just...
Well, let's continue, because I want to get to the end, because I think I've got a positive angle on this towards the end of these notes today. But this theme continues in something that I talked about this week. You know, there was this shooting at YouTube. And, you know, this crazy woman, vegan, whatever, and she goes and she... Her complaint was that YouTube was censoring her, and this was her reaction. And so what I said on my show was that
there are... Wait a minute. Is it possible? She was a leftist. I thought YouTube is a leftist organization that only censors right-wing activists. How could it's not possible. I mean, she's lying. Okay. This is obviously a conspiracy theory. Sure. YouTube did this to itself. I mean, because no, they only censor right-wing activists.
I mean, there's a couple things. First of all, I didn't see a whole lot of her videos, but I saw a little bit. She's just kind of bad. But the other thing is that I think that YouTube, like any of these other big, you know, social media giants, has automated algorithms that will not, you know, like filter content out, sometimes temporarily, sometimes more permanently. But some of her content was very graphic because she was an animal rights activist. So she'd have, you know, really graphic depictions of slaughter of animals and stuff. And so I sort of wonder whether there was some filtering that went on one way or the other. It doesn't matter, right? Because here she is, her complaint is censorship. And her answer is she's going to go there and shoot up some people. And what I was saying on my show is, look, what she did is a, you know, real life in your face dramatization of what a number of people are calling for, which is they want force to be applied to these social media giants, but they don't want, you know, people to go in and like shoot them up like she did and stuff. Instead, they want to do it politely. They want their representatives in Congress to vote for government to force the companies to behave in certain ways. So, you know, the force isn't going to be applied directly to the employees. They're not going to be shot or anything like that. It's all going to be polite and above the board. But in the end, that's what they're doing. People want force to be applied to these companies. That's their answer. And you know, a couple things occurred to me about this. One is people are dropping principles left and right in these cases. So immigration, drop principles, trade, drop principles, regulate companies, no, drop principles here. There's always a reason that we have to drop our principles today. And the ones who are willing to do this in all of these areas, I wonder, can you think anymore? You had the show talking about the importance of principle and how principle is the thing that our reason uses. I mean, we think in principles. That's the way that we think. If you find yourself constantly, oh, well, principle doesn't apply here and there over here, how do you think clearly anymore? That's just a question, you know? And then the other thing too is, particularly in this area, you don't want government control, because this is the distributor of all the content that's going to be necessary to change the culture for the better and achieve the day of limited government. I mean, the whole purpose of, supposedly the purpose of calling for censorship of YouTube is to work towards a day of limited government. And there's no way to achieve that. Once the government gets its control over the distribution, not only the distribution of the content, you know, and let me question myself, but okay, well, I'll finish the thought and then I'll do the devil's advocate. Cause I'm a woman, women do this. We go off in tangents. So finishing the thought is if, no, we do.
We don't. Where did that come from?
I've seen the graphs that they draw of, you know, women that their thoughts go around like this and then eventually come back and men are more straight line. That's supposedly how it works.
But I have a female side, obviously, because I go on tangents all the time.
That's why I like you so much.
Female side. It's my female
side. That's right. No, so if we let government control that all these internet social media giants, which is where we are conducting this battle of ideas to try to change the culture for the better, government will just clamp down. We're not going to be able to make progress. I don't see how that's going to help. So then you could say, oh, Amy, you're overreacting because government has been regulating media for a really long time, right? But this type of media that we have today, I submit is different because the media that we have today not only distributes content, but it collects information about all of us. So it makes it that much more, I think, dangerous to us personally, any of us who want to change the culture and try to fight for a different type of government. Because if government gets control over these outlets are not just distributing content, they're collecting information about us. And that makes it all the more crucial that we keep these free. I don't see any interim strategy towards moving towards a society of limited government that involves arguing for regulation of these social media giants. So again,
And that's the thing about, you know, everybody says the left is anti-free speech and at least the right, at least Trump is pro-free speech. Oh my God. I mean, read the National Review, read all these conservative thinkers who are now actively arguing for the regulation of Twitter and Facebook and YouTube on grounds of speech, right? So they're on the grounds that they're not fair in terms of speech. Regulating private property, what is said on private property. Look at Dennis Prager, the icon of conservatism, you know, and he's even a libertarian in some issues, right? Because he's got free market videos and all this stuff. Here he is suing YouTube, and all these right wingers are supporting his lawsuit. So, you know, I can't think of anything more dangerous right now in the world, more dangerous than Guatemalans coming across the border, more dangerous than trade with China, more dangerous than ISIS and Al-Qaeda, more dangerous than Iran getting a nuclear bomb is the idea that Democrats and Republicans share that internet companies now must be regulated and their content based on not just their size, but based on content. The idea that you would go after Amazon, which Trump wants to do in order to silence the Washington Post, which is all part of this. It's all going after so-called elites who control the media. This is the real threat. So this is my point. Again, we are the problem. Republicans and Democrats are the problem. It's not the Chinese. It's not illegal immigrants. It's not Guatemalans. It's not ISIS. It's not Muslims. Oh, Muslims. Oh, my God. Right.
Or YouTube or Facebook.
Or YouTube or Facebook. The problem is all of us who are arguing now to have internet companies regulated, we are going to destroy this country, and we will destroy it much faster than ISIS or Al-Qaeda or illegal immigrants ever, or even Democrats ever will.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the problem. So,
can we be positive? We got 10 minutes, 12 minutes.
I know. Okay. Well, let me just give you one hint of something that I'm watching, and we won't go too deeply into it. Facebook is being hauled before, you know, Zuckerberg going before Congress, and he has made, which may be some sort of concession already to lawmakers, which is that he's going to now check groups behind issue ads, make people who place ads about certain political issues, make them identify themselves and confirm their location, et cetera.
Okay.
Because, I mean, it's so scary to have these ads, you know, these issue ads put in front of you. You must be protected. And so Zuckerberg
is... Because we're automatons. We just do what the marketers tell us.
Yeah. So the thing that I find ominous about that is that Zuckerberg might willingly give some concessions to the government and start allowing more controls to take place. It's just something to watch. That's all.
Well, I mean, I think the internet companies are looking right now, just like China, at how they can cut a deal so that they, because they see the winds are changing. They see that the Republicans and the Democrats are now uniting in their desire to regulate them and control them. And I think they are going to compromise, cut deals, and find ways to try to mitigate that risk. And it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah. So in terms of ending more on a positive, I've got, you know, a couple thoughts to consider for people. One is from Rand, the issue of motivation by love versus motivation by fear, to try to have everybody sort of, you know, turn themselves more towards that. You're shaking your head no. Why?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's the bottom line. I've always said, but I don't think objectivists get this. Objectivism is the philosophy of love. It really is the philosophy of love. It's about loving life. It's about loving your life and therefore loving life. It's about loving other human beings, whether they're Americans or not, because they are potentially productive and creative and can do things. It's about loving the fact that there are good things in the world and all those good things in the world, and loving the fact that you know, Walmart exists and Apple exists and Amazon exists, and not obsessing about all the problems and not obsessing about all the evils and dangers. Because at the end of the day, if you give up that motivation by love, if you give up that desire for values, if you give up that passion for values, then what's life worth living for anyway, right? What are you afraid of at that point? Might as well, you know, life is worth living because of love. It's not worth living because of a negation of fear.
Yes.
It's worth living because of the values one has and the pursuit of those values. And, you know, so I travel all over the world. You know, so as compared to other people who comment about the state of the world and the state of all these countries, I actually visit the countries and actually see what's going on. And they are amazing people everywhere. And they are productive people. And they are people who are passionate about freedom and about liberty and even about objectivism, about Ayn Rand. We were just driving in Porto Alegre in Brazil just a couple of hours ago. And the guy who was driving the car says, look at the bumper sticker over there. And there's a car driving away with a bumper sticker that says, "Where's John Galt?" in Portuguese, right?
Wonderful.
Random in Porto Alegre. And you know, and if you come here and you see the vibrancy, the people, it's much better than it was when I previously visited. The economy is recovering and things are going better. If you see the number of people who come in Argentina to engage in discussion and debate, if you go to other countries around the world, and you know, people rile about China without knowing anything about China, but you see the skyscrapers, mm-hmm. which I think are a symbol of something. And you go to even in the Middle East, I see some positive trends, right? I mean, the Saudi Crown Prince just finished his tour of the United States. I think I just read a headline. And this guy really, I think we've talked about this before. I mean, it really looks like he's making changes.
There is a kind of question mark hanging over him. I've heard different perspectives from different people.
Sure.
Is it all just show and he's really not sincere? And
he actually said that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. Who's he showing that to? For what?
To Kiev of some kind. I don't know. I mean, anyway.
I think the real question is he going to be assassinated or not? Will he live past the age of 40 or not? That's the real question. But the fact is that he is a young Saudi who's obviously Western, who's been Westernized. One of my standards is the number of clerics he has in jail. Huge number of clerics. The more you know, militant ones are in jail now in Saudi Arabia. Okay. So, you know, yes, we got to be cynical. We got to be suspicious. We got to check. But it looks like there's a little bit of evidence that maybe Saudi Arabia is moving in a good direction. You know, let's hope that that's true instead of being all negative about, oh, Muslims, they can't reform. Muslims, they can't be any better. Muslims, they, you know, they're the enemy as is. No, here's some Muslims who might be moving in the right direction, and we should be happy about that. You know, there's less poverty in the world than ever before. There's less violence in the world than ever before. The world is freer than in any point in human history, probably, right? Maybe it was freer 10 years ago, but no, I think right now more people live under semi-free governments than any period in human history. The world is more peaceful. There are fewer wars than ever in human history. If you don't see that, if you can't see that, if you want to live in fear in spite of all of that, if you want to believe that the catastrophe, the end of the world, is just coming tomorrow, then, you know, I feel sorry for you because your life is going to be miserable, and it is miserable. I read a story. Just one last thing. I read a story in the Wall Street Journal on a massive shortage in the United States of construction workers, because they all went back to Mexico after the financial crisis when there was no construction. They went back to Mexico, and now there's good jobs in Mexico, so they're not coming to the United States. So there's a massive shortage in the United States of construction workers. So what we should do with the caravan is we should set up a checkpoint, and if you can do construction, funnel them in, give them a special visa, and send them directly to contractors who need construction workers. Right? I mean, that would be a huge improvement.
Well, and there's other low-skilled workers that are needed as well.
And that's a motivation by love, right? We want workers. We want to build. We want a thriving economy. We want people to come to America to work. Those are the kind of people we want to attract. So let's make that the criteria. I'm fine with making a criteria to come to the United States that you're committed to working, and that you will monitor the fact that you're working. That's fine. But the rejection, the resentment, the hatred, the fear, that's un-American and just sad. It's sad to see.
So for those of us who sometimes do get ourselves sucked into the fear, I'm going to share something that I found that was interesting. Because again, you know, I was looking at this title and, you know, brainstorming on this title. And I came upon this article, and it's from Gizmodo. Headline: the U.S. national anthem has a question mark after Home of the Brave. So apparently in the original draft from Francis Scott Key, there was a question mark after Home of the Brave. And in the article, it says that it was there. The question marks in the draft were there to express a sense of fear and anxiety during the time it was written. So if you can imagine that this song, which we always associate with a very positive outlook, you know, that things for America are more auspicious and stuff, but there are times where there are things that are going to make you anxious. And nonetheless, I think the constant choice for everybody is to choose that motivation by love whenever possible, to be brave.
You know, Franklin said, a republic if you can keep it. And it's all the same sentiments. There's no guarantee that America will be brave. There's no guarantee that Americans are brave. We have to be brave. It's a choice. It's a hard choice. It's not a
constant choice. A constant choice.
Courage is not easy. Courage is a virtue. I think it's a virtue under integrity, but it is a virtue. And courage and benevolence is a choice one has to make. But the opposite, the choice of malevolence and fear, nothing good can come of those choices. Nothing. So it's easy to be negative. It's because that's, you know, that's the condition under which, at the perceptual level, it's very hard to survive. at the perceptual level.
Is it easy or not? You know, Rand used to say, I'm afraid to be a coward because I see the consequences too clearly. Perhaps.
Yeah, but that's because she's a thinking being. You see, to be courageous, you have to think. To be courageous, you have to be engaged. To be courageous, you have to turn it on. You have to be in focus. The default is fear. When we're living naked in the jungle, we fear the snakes. We fear the cheetahs. We fear the everything, right? Everything is scary, and we're constantly, and we have to build homes. We have to engage our rational faculty to overcome our fear and to protect ourselves, right? To build the infrastructure and to build the thought processes and the physical infrastructure that are required in order to survive as a species. But every time we go backwards, every time we abandon rationality, every time we abandon reason and become emotional again, then the dominant emotion, if you're in a perceptual level, if you're not thinking constantly, then the dominant emotion has to be fear, because the fact is you don't know how to deal with the world. The only way to know how to deal with the world, the only way to know how to survive, the only way to know how to thrive and flourish is to use your mind. It's to be rational. It's to use reason.
And that's what we're going to need to hear more of from you this summer. So that's what I think. Yeah. I'll be there.
Yeah. It's going to be fun. The talk will be fun this summer, because I think it'll have two conflicting elements. One is the audience and the natural pessimism and negativity that objectivists have always had. And of course, you know, that objectivist philosophers have always had, and that's just permeated objectivism. And it's going to be, you know, what do you do with that? And how do you give a speech about being optimistic when that is being the constant in objectivism? And then secondly, it's my own pessimism, right? It's how do I deal with the fact that I know that in fundamental terms, in real terms, there's a lot of really bad things going on in the world, and particularly in America. Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, that my attitude towards Trump and my attitude towards Republicans and Democrats and the whole political world out there. How do I present a talk about being optimistic when I myself am very aware of all the negative things that are going on? How do you balance that out? And how do you convince people that they shouldn't think that way? But love is certainly a key theme.
Well, I have to go now, but between now and then, I promise to try to bring more positive things in here wherever I can, and I'll steep myself in pinker and everything else, okay? But I
well, and look, I'm sitting here, Porto Alegre, Brazil, which is a
we're online.
Yeah, you're home. You're in civilization.
Actually, we're doing
everybody
this.
According to YouTube, I'm in like the dark ages when I travel around the world, because the rest of the world is a disaster. It's horrible. It's disgusting. Only in America. Can you even have any kind of semblance of civilization? No. I mean, it's amazingly civilized here. I mean, it could be much, 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 much better. And for the same ways, America could be much, much better. But the world is a phenomenal, wonderful, exciting, great place with fantastic, great people. And we got to be, while being American exceptionalist, we cannot be Americans, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
I was going to say snobs, but there's a different
American
word.
American snobs is probably a good word. We can't be American snob. Well, not in snobs, but think that our consciousness is only focused on America, that all we see is America, all we know is America, and the rest of the world either doesn't exist or is a threat, is a risk, is something to be afraid of. No, the rest of the world is amazing, is beautiful. There's huge potential. The movement for freedom and liberty and the objectivist movement today is a global movement. It's yep. And you've gotta get your head out of your, I won't say, and start looking around the world and see what's going on in the world and how wonderful and how there are a lot of wonderful things going on in the world and how life is great. And stop being so negative and conspiratorial and afraid.
Yep.
It's fantastic.
Fear, anyway. Fear is not an appropriate component.
Oh, somebody just gave $1.99 for you, Amy. So I owe you $1.99.
Sweet. Okay. I got to go. Got to go. Yes, thank you guys.
All right.
And I'll see you next time. I'll talk to you, Yaron.
Yep. Bye, everybody. Okay.